He reasoned that he wouldn't need much if God had sent the invitation, but just in case, he loaded up a cooler with much more than enough for the miles he would be traveling, and then added a sleeping bag, some candles, matches, and a number of other survival items. There was no doubt the possibility that he had turned into a complete idiot, or was the butt of some ugly prank, but he would then be free to just drive away. A knock at the door startled Mac from his concentration, and he could see that it was Willie. Their conversation must have been sufficiently perplexing to warrant an early visit. Mac was just relieved that Nan had already left.
"I'm in here, Willie. In the kitchen."
A moment later, Willie poked his head around the hall corner and shook his head, looking at the mess that Mac had made. He leaned against the door jamb and crossed his arms.
"Well, I brought the Jeep, and it's full of gas, but I'm not handing over the keys until you tell me exactly what is going on."
Mac continued piling things into a couple bags for the trip. He knew it was no use lying to his friend, and he needed the Jeep.
"I'm going back to the shack, Willie." "Well, I figured that much out already. What I want to know is why you even want to go back there, especially at this time of year. I don't know if my old Jeep will even keep us on the roads up there, but just in case, I put some chains in the back if we need them."
Without looking at him, Mac walked to the office, pried the lid off the small tin box, and took out the note. Re-entering the kitchen, he handed it to Willie. His friend unfolded the paper and read silently.
"Jeez, what kind of loony kook would write you something like this? And who is this Papa?"
"Well, you know, Papa, Nan's favorite name for God." Mac shrugged, not sure what else to say. He took back the note and slid it into his shirt pocket.
"Wait, you aren't thinking this is really from God, are you?"
Mac stopped and turned to face him. He had just about finished packing, anyway.
"Willie, I'm not sure what to think about this. I mean, at first I thought it was just a hoax, and it made me angry and sick to my stomach. Maybe I'm just losing it. I know it sounds crazy, but somehow I feel strangely drawn to find out for sure. I gotta go, Willie, or it'll drive me nuts forever."
"Have you thought of the possibility that this might be the killer? What if he's luring you back for some reason?"
"Of course I've thought of that. Part of me won't be disappointed if it is. I have a score to settle with him.
But that doesn't make a lot of sense either. I'm not thinking the killer would sign this note, Papa. You have to really know our family to come up with that."
Willie was perplexed.
"And no one who knows us that well would ever send a note like this. I'm thinking only God would."
"Maybe."
"But God doesn't do stuff like that. At least I've never heard of him sending someone a note. Not that he couldn't, but you know what I mean. And why would he want you to return to the shack anyway? I can't think of a worse place."
The silence that hung between them grew awkward. Mac leaned back against the counter and stared a hole through the floor before speaking. "I'm not sure, Willie. I guess part of me would like to believe that God would care enough about me to send a note. I'm so confused, even after all this time. I just don't know what to think, and it isn't getting better. I feel like we're losing Kate, and that's killing me. Maybe what happened to Missy is God's judgment for what I did to my own dad. I just don't know." He looked up into the face of a man who cared more about him than anyone he knew, except Nan.
"All I know is that I need to go back."
There was silence between them before Willie spoke again.
"So, when do we leave?"
Mac was touched by his friend's willingness to jump into his insanity.
"Thanks, buddy, but I really need to do this alone."
"I thought you'd say that,"
Willie responded as he turned and walked out of the room. He returned a few moments later with a pistol and a box of shells in his hands. He gently laid them on the counter.
"I figured I wouldn't be able to talk you out of going, so I thought you might need this. I believe you know how to use it."
Mac looked at the gun. He knew Willie meant well and was trying to help.
"Willie, I can't. It's been 30 years since I last touched a gun, and I don't intend to now. If I learned anything back then, it was that using violence to solve a problem always landed me in a worse problem. But what if it is Missy's killer? What if he's waiting for you up there? What are you going to do then?"
"I honestly don't know, Willie. I'll take my chances, I guess.
But you'll be defenseless. There's no telling what he has in mind or in hand. Just take it, Mac.
Willie slid the pistol and shells across the counter toward him.
You don't have to use it.
Mac looked down at the gun and, after some deliberation, reached slowly for it and the shells, putting them carefully in his pocket.
Okay, just in case.
He then turned to pick up some of his equipment and, arms loaded, headed out toward the Jeep. Willie grabbed the large duffel bag remaining, finding it heavier than he had anticipated, and grunted as he hoisted it.
Geez, Mac, if you think God is going to be up there, why all the supplies?
Mac smiled rather sadly. I just thought I'd cover my bases. You know, be prepared for whatever happens. Or doesn't. They made their way out of the house to the driveway where the Jeep sat. Willie pulled the keys out of his pocket and handed them to Mac.
So, where is everybody? What did Nan think of you heading out for the shack? I can't imagine she was real pleased.
Nan and the kids are visiting her sister up in the islands, and I didn't tell her.
What? You never keep secrets from her. I can't believe you lied to her.
I didn't lie to her.
Well, excuse me for splitting hairs. Okay, you didn't lie to her because you didn't tell her the whole truth. Oh, yeah, she's going to understand that all right.
He rolled his eyes. Mac ignored the outburst and walked back to the house and into his office. There he found the spare set of keys for his car and home and, hesitating for just a moment, picked up the small tin box. He then headed back out toward Willie.
So, what do you think he looks like?
Who?
God, of course. What do you think he'll look like, if he even bothers to show up, I mean? Boy, I can just see you scaring the living daylights out of some poor hiker, asking him if he's God, and then demanding answers and all.
Mac grinned at the thought. I don't know. Maybe he's a really bright light or a burning bush. I've always sort of pictured him as a really big grandpa with a long, white, flowing beard, sort of like Gandalf in Tolkien's Lord of the Rings. He shrugged and handed Willie his keys, and they exchanged a brief hug. Willie climbed into Mac's car and rolled down the driver's window.
Well, if he does show, say hi for me.
Tell him I have a few questions of my own, and, Mac, try not to piss him off. They both laughed.
Seriously, I'm concerned for you, buddy. I wish I was going with you, or Nan, or someone. I hope you find everything you need up there. I will be saying a prayer or two for you.
Thanks, Willie. I love you, too. He waved as Willie backed out of the driveway. Mac knew that his friend would keep his word. He probably could use all the prayers he could get. He watched until Willie was around the corner and out of sight, then slipped the note from his shirt pocket, read it one more time, and then placed it into the little tin box, which he deposited on the passenger seat amongst some of the other gear stacked there. Locking the doors, he headed back into the house and a sleepless night. Well before dawn on Friday, Mac was already out of town and traveling down I-84. Nan had called the night before from her sisters to let him know that they had made it safe and sound, and he didn't expect to get another call until at least Sunday. By that time, he would probably be on his way back, if he wasn't home already. He forwarded the house phone to his cell, just in case, not that he would have any reception once he was into the reserve. He retraced the same path they had taken 3.5 years before, with a few minor changes, not as many potty breaks, and he sailed by Multnomah Falls without looking. He had pushed away any thoughts of the place since Missy's disappearance, sequestering his emotions securely in the padlocked basement of his own heart. On the long stretch up the gorge, Mac felt a creeping panic begin to penetrate his consciousness. He had tried to avoid thinking about what he was doing and just keep putting one foot in front of the other, but like grass pushing through concrete, the repressed feelings and fears somehow began to poke through. His eyes darkened, and his hands tightened on the steering wheel as he fought the temptation at every off-ramp to turn around and go home. He knew he was driving straight into the center of his pain, the vortex of the great sadness that had so diminished his sense of being alive. Flashes of visual memory and stabbing instants of blistering fury now came in waves, attended by the taste of bile and blood in his mouth. He finally reached LeGrand, where he gassed up, and then took Highway 82 out to Joseph. He was half tempted to stop and look in on Tommy, but decided against it. The fewer people who thought he was a raving lunatic, the better. Instead, he topped off his tank and headed out. Traffic was light, and the Imnaha and smaller roads were remarkably clear and dry for this time of year, much warmer than he had expected. But it seemed that the farther he drove, the slower he traveled, as if the shack were somehow repelling his approach. The jeep crossed the snow line as he climbed the last couple of miles to the trail that would take him down to the shack. Above the whine of the engine, he could hear the tires crunch doggedly through the deepening snow and ice. Even after a couple of wrong turns and some backtracking, it was only early afternoon when Mac finally pulled over and parked at the barely visible trailhead. He sat there for almost 5 minutes, reprimanding himself for being such a fool. With every mile that he had traveled from Joseph, the memories had come back with adrenaline clarity, and now he was mentally certain that he wanted to go no farther. But the inner compulsion to press on was irresistible. Even as he argued with himself, he buttoned up his coat and reached for his leather gloves. He stood and stared down the path, deciding to leave everything in the car and hike the mile or so down to the lake. At least that way he wouldn't have to lug anything back up the hill when he returned to leave, which he now expected would be in very short order. It was cold enough that his breath hung in the air around him, and it even felt like it might snow. The pain that had been building in his stomach finally pushed him into panic. After only 5 steps, he stopped and retched so strongly that it brought him to his knees. "Please, help me." He stood up on shaky legs and took another step away from the car. Then he stopped and turned back. He opened the passenger door and reached in, rummaging around until he felt the small tin box. He pried the lid off and found what he was looking for, his favorite picture of Missy, which he removed along with the note. Replacing the lid, he left the box on the seat. He paused for a moment looking at the glove box. Finally, he opened it and grabbed Willie's gun, checking to make sure it was loaded and the safety was on. Standing up, he closed the door, reached under his coat, and stuck the gun in his belt in the small of his back. He turned and faced the path once more, taking one last look at Missy's picture before sliding it into his shirt pocket alongside the note. If they found him dead, at least they would know who had been on his mind. The trail was treacherous, the rocks icy and slippery. Every step took concentration as he descended into the thickening forest. It was eerily quiet. The only sounds he could hear were the crunch of his steps on the snow and the heaviness of his breathing. Mac started feeling like he was being watched, and once he even spun around quickly to see if anyone was there. As much as he wanted to turn and run back to the jeep, his feet seemed to have a will of their own, determined to continue down the path and deeper into the dimly lit and increasingly dense woods. Suddenly, something moved close by. Startled, he froze, silent and alert. With his heart pounding in his ears and his mouth suddenly dry, he slowly reached behind his back, sliding the pistol from his belt. Snapping off the safety, he peered intensely into the dark underbrush, trying to see or hear anything that might explain the noise and slow the rush of adrenaline. But whatever had moved had now stopped. Was it waiting for him? Just in case, he stood motionless for a few minutes before he began again inching his way farther down the trail, trying to be as quiet as possible. The forest seemed to close in around him, and he began to seriously wonder if he had taken the wrong path. Out of the corner of his eye, he again saw movement and instantly crouched down, peering between the low branches of a nearby tree. Something ghostly, like a shadow, slipped into the brush. Or had he only imagined it? Again, he waited, not shifting a muscle. Was that God? He doubted it. Maybe an animal. He couldn't remember if there were wolves up here, and deer or elk would make more noise. and then the thought he had been avoiding. What if it was worse? What if he had been lured up here? But for what? Slowly rising from his hiding place, gun still drawn, he took a step forward when suddenly the bush behind him seemed to explode. Mac whipped around, scared and ready to fight for his life. But before he could squeeze the trigger, he recognized the rear end of a badger scampering back up the trail. He slowly exhaled the breath he hadn't realized he'd been holding, lowered his gun, and shook his head. Mac the Courageous had been reduced to just another scared boy in the woods. Snapping the safety back on, he tucked the gun away. Someone could get hurt, he thought with a sigh of relief. Taking another deep breath and exhaling slowly, he calmed himself. Determined that he was done being afraid, he continued down the path, trying to look more confident than he felt. He hoped he hadn't come all this way for nothing. If God was really meeting him here, he was more than ready to get a few things off his chest. Respectfully, of course. A few turns later, he stumbled out of the woods and into a clearing. At the far side and down the slope, he saw it again. The shack. He stood, staring at it, his stomach a ball of motion and turmoil. On the surface, it seemed that nothing had changed, other than the winter's stripping of the deciduous trees and the white shroud of snow that blanketed the surroundings. The shack itself looked dead and empty. But as he stared, it seemed for a moment to transform into an evil face, twisted in some demonic grimace, looking straight back at him and daring him to approach. Ignoring the rising panic he was feeling, Mac walked with resolve down the last 100 yards and up onto the porch. The memories and horror of the last time he stood at this door came flooding back, and he hesitated before pushing it open. "Hello?" he called, not too loudly. Clearing his throat, he called again, this time louder. "Hello? Anybody here?" His voice echoed off the emptiness inside. Feeling bolder, he stepped completely across the threshold and stopped. As his eyes adjusted in the dimness, he began to make out the details of the room by the afternoon light filtering in through the broken windows. Stepping into the main room, he recognized the old chairs and table. Mac couldn't help himself as his eyes were drawn to the one place he could not bear to look. Even after a few years, the faded bloodstain was still clearly visible in the wood near the fireplace where they had found Missy's dress.
"I'm so sorry, honey."
Tears began to well up in his eyes. And finally, his heart exploded like a flash flood, releasing his pent-up anger and letting it rush down the rocky canyons of his emotions. Turning his eyes heavenward, he began screaming his anguished questions.
"Why? Why did you let this happen? Why did you bring me here, of all the places to meet you? Why here? Wasn't enough to kill my baby? Do you have to toy with me, too?"
In a blind rage, Mac grabbed the nearest chair and flung it at the window. It smashed into pieces. He picked up one of the legs and began destroying everything he could. Groans and moans of despair and fury spat through his lips as he beat his wrath into this terrible place.
"I hate you!"
In a frenzy, he pounded out his rage until he was exhausted and spent. Despairing and defeated, Max slumped to the floor next to the bloodstain. He touched it carefully. This was all that was left of his Missy. As he lay next to her, his fingers tenderly traced the discolored edges.
"Missy, I'm so sorry. I'm sorry I couldn't protect you. I'm sorry I couldn't find you."
Even in his exhaustion, the anger seethed, and he once again took aim at the indifferent God he imagined somewhere beyond the roof of the shack.
"God, you couldn't even let us find her and bury her properly. Was that just too much to ask?"
As the mix of emotions ebbed and flowed, his anger giving way to pain, a fresh wave of sorrow began to mix with his confusion.
So where are you? I thought you wanted to meet me here. Well, I'm here, God. And you? You're nowhere to be found. You've never been around when I needed you. Not when I was a little boy. Not when I lost Missy. Not now. Some papa you are.
Max sat there in silence, the emptiness of the place invading his soul. His jumble of unanswered questions and far-flung accusations settled to the floor with him, and then slowly drained into a pit of desolation. The great sadness tightened around him, and he almost welcomed the smothering sensation. This pain, he knew. He was familiar with it, almost like a friend. Mac could feel the gun in the small of his back. An inviting cold pressed against his skin. He pulled it out, not sure what he was going to do. Oh, to stop caring. To stop feeling the pain. To never feel anything again. Suicide. At the moment, that option was almost attractive. It would be so easy. No more tears. No more pain. He could almost see a black chasm opening up in the floor behind the gun he was staring at, a darkness sucking any last vestiges of hope from his heart. Killing himself would be one way to strike back at God, if God even existed. Clouds parted outside, and a sunbeam suddenly spilled into the room, piercing the center of his despair. What about Nan? What about Josh, or Kate, or Tyler, and John? As much as he longed to stop the ache in his heart, he knew he could not add to their hurt. Max sat in his emotionally spent stupor, weighing the options in the feel of the gun. A cold breeze brushed past his face, and part of him wanted to just lie down and freeze to death. He was so exhausted. He slumped back against the wall and rubbed his weary eyes. He let them fall closed.
I love you, Missy. I miss you so much.
Soon he drifted without effort into dead sleep. It was probably only minutes later that Mac woke with a jerk. Surprised that he nodded off, he stood up quickly, stuffing the gun back into his waistband and his anger back into the deepest part of his soul. He started for the door. This is ridiculous. I'm such an idiot. To think that I hope God might actually care enough to send me a note. He looked up into the open rafters.
I'm done, God. I can't do this anymore. I'm tired of trying to find you in all of this.
And with that, he walked out the door. Mac determined that this was the last time he would go looking for God. If God wanted him, God would have to come find him. He reached into his pocket and took out the note he had found in his mailbox and tore it into little pieces, letting it slowly sift through his fingers to be carried off by the cold wind that had kicked up. A weary old man, he stepped off the porch and with heavy footsteps and a heavier heart, started the hike back to the car. He had barely walked 50 feet up the trail when he felt a sudden rush of warm air overtake him from behind. The chirping of a songbird broke the icy silence. The path in front of him rapidly lost its veneer of snow and ice as if someone were blow-drying it. Max stopped and watched as all around him the white covering dissolved and was replaced by emerging and radiant growth. 3 weeks of spring unfurled before him in 30 seconds. He rubbed his eyes and steadied himself in the swirl of activity. Even the light snow that had begun to fall had changed to tiny blossoms, lazily drifting to the ground. What he was seeing, of course, was not possible. The snowbanks had vanished, and summer wildflowers began to color the borders of the trail and into the forest as far as he could see. Robins and finches darted after one another among the trees. Squirrels and chipmunks occasionally crossed the path ahead, some stopping to sit up and watch him for a moment before plunging back into the undergrowth. He even thought that he glimpsed a young buck emerging out of a dark glade in the forest, but on second look it was gone. As if that weren't enough, the scent of blooms began to fill the air, not just the drifting aroma of wild mountain flowers, but the richness of roses and orchids and other exotic fragrances found in more tropical climes. Mac was no longer thinking about home. A terror gripped him, as if he had opened up Pandora's box and was being swept away into the center of madness, to be lost forever. Unsteady, he carefully turned around, trying to hold on to some sense of sanity. He was stunned. Little, if anything, was the same. The dilapidated shack had been replaced by a sturdy and beautifully constructed log cabin, now standing directly between him and the lake, which he could see just above the rooftop. It was built out of hand-peeled, full-length logs, every one scribed for a perfect fit. Instead of the dark and forbidding overgrowth of brush, briars, and devil's club, everything that Mac could see was now postcard perfect. Smoke was lazily wending its way from the chimney into the late afternoon sky, a sign of activity inside. A walkway had been built to and around the front porch, bordered by a small white picket fence. The sound of laughter was coming from nearby. Maybe inside, but he wasn't sure. Perhaps this is what it was like to experience a complete psychotic break. I'm losing it. Now, this can't be happening. This isn't real. It was a place that Mac could only have imagined in his best dreams, and this made it all the more suspect. The sights were wondrous, the scents intoxicating, and his feet, as if they had a mind of their own, took him back down the walkway and up onto the front porch. Flowers bloomed everywhere, and the mix of floral fragrances and pungent herbs aroused hints of memories long forgotten. He had always heard that the nose was the best link to the past, that the olfactory sense was the strongest for tapping into forgotten history. And now, some long-stored remembrances of his own childhood flitted through his mind. Once on the porch, he stopped again. Voices were clearly coming from inside. Mac rejected the sudden impulse to run away, as if he were some kid who'd thrown his ball into a neighbor's flower garden. But if God is inside, it wouldn't do much good anyway, would it? He closed his eyes and shook his head to see if he could erase the hallucination and restore reality, but when he opened them, it was all still there. He tentatively reached out and touched the wood railing. It certainly seemed real. He now faced another dilemma. What should you do when you come to the door of a house, or cabin in this case, where God might be? Should you knock? Presumably God already knew that Mac was there. Maybe he ought to simply walk in and introduce himself. But that seemed equally absurd. And how should he address him? Should he call him Father, or Almighty One, or perhaps Mr. God? And would it be best if he fell down and worshipped? Not that he was really in the mood. As he tried to establish some inner mental balance, the anger that he thought had so recently died inside him began to emerge. No longer concerned or caring about what to call God, and energized by his ire, he walked up to the door. Mac decided to bang loudly and see what happened, but just as he raised his fist to do so, the door flew open, and he was looking directly into the face of a large, beaming African-American woman. Instinctively, he jumped back, but he was too slow. With speed that belied her size, she crossed the distance between them and engulfed him in her arms, lifting him clear off his feet and spinning him around like a little child, and all the while she was shouting his name. "Mackenzie Allen Phillips?" With the ardor of someone seeing a long-lost and deeply loved relative, she finally put him back on earth and, with her hands on his shoulders, pushed him back as if to get a good look at him. "Mac, look at you. Here you are and so grown up.
I have really been looking forward to seeing you face to face. It is so wonderful to have you here with us. My, 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 how I do love you. And with that, she wrapped herself around him again. Mac was speechless. In a few seconds, this woman had breached pretty much every social propriety behind which he had so safely entrenched himself. But something in the way that she had looked at him and yelled his name made him equally delighted to see her too, even though he didn't have a clue who she was. Suddenly, he was overwhelmed by the scent emanating from her, and it shook him. It was the smell of flowers with overtones of gardenia and jasmine, unmistakably his mother's perfume that he had kept hidden away in his little tin box. He had already been perched precariously on the precipice of emotion, and now the flooding scent and attendant memories staggered him. He could feel the warmth of tears beginning to gather behind his eyes, as if they were knocking on the door of his heart. It seemed that she saw them, too. "It's okay, honey. You can let it all out. I know you've been hurt, and I know you're angry and confused. So go ahead, let it out. It does a soul good to let the waters run once in a while, the healing waters." But while Mac could not stop the tears from filling his eyes, he was not ready to let go, not yet, not with this woman. With every effort he could muster, he kept himself from falling back into the black hole of his emotions. Meanwhile, this woman stood there with her arms outstretched as if they were the very arms of his mother. He felt the presence of love. It was warm, inviting, melting. "Not ready? That's okay. We'll do things on your terms and time. Well, come on in. Can I take your coat? And that gun. You don't really need that, do you? We wouldn't want anyone to get hurt, would we?" Mac wasn't sure what to do or what to say. Who was she? And how did she know? He was rooted to the spot where he stood, but slowly and mechanically took off his coat. The large black woman gathered his coat, and he handed her the gun, which she took from him with two fingers, as if it was contaminated. Just as she turned to enter the cabin, a small, distinctively Asian woman emerged from behind her. "Here, let me take those," her voice sang. Obviously, she had not meant the coat or gun, but something else, and she was in front of him in a blink of an eye. He stiffened as he felt something sweep gently across his cheek. Without moving, he looked down and could see that she was busy with a fragile crystal bottle and a small brush, like those he'd seen Nan and Kate use for makeup, gently removing something from his face. Before he could ask, she smiled and whispered, "Mackenzie, we all have things we value enough to collect, don't we?" His little tin box flashed through his mind. "I collect tears." As she stepped back, Mac found himself involuntarily squinting in her direction, as if doing so would allow his eyes to see her better. But strangely, he still had a difficult time focusing on her. She seemed almost to shimmer in the light, and her hair blew in all directions, even though there was hardly a breeze. It was almost easier to see her out of the corner of his eye than it was to look at her directly. He then glanced past her and noticed that a third person had emerged from the cabin, this one a man. He appeared Middle Eastern and was dressed like a laborer, complete with tool belt and gloves. He stood easily leaning against the door jamb with his arms crossed in front of him, wearing jeans covered in wood dust and a plaid shirt with sleeves rolled just above the elbows, revealing well-muscled forearms. His features were pleasant enough, but he was not particularly handsome. Not a man who would stick out in a crowd, but his eyes and smile lit up his face, and Mac found it difficult to look away. Mac stepped back again, feeling a bit overwhelmed. "Are there more of you?" The three looked at one another and laughed. Mac couldn't help but smile. "No, Mackenzie, we's all that you get, and believe me, we're more than enough." Mac tried again to look at the Asian woman. From what he could tell, this wiry-looking person was maybe of northern Chinese or Nepalese or even Mongolian ethnicity. It was hard to tell because his eyes had to work to see her at all. From her clothing, Mac assumed she was a groundskeeper or gardener. She had gloves folded into her belt, not the heavy leathers of the man, but the lightweight cloth and rubber ones that Mac himself used for yard work at home. She was dressed in plain jeans with ornamental designs at the fringes, knees covered in dirt from where she had been kneeling, and a brightly colored blouse with splashes of yellow and red and blue. But he knew all this as more an impression of her than from actually seeing her, as she seemed to phase in and out of his vision. The man then stepped in, touched Mac on the shoulder, gave him a kiss on both cheeks, and embraced him strongly. Mac knew instantly that he liked him. As they separated, the man stepped back, and the Asian lady moved toward him again, this time taking his face in both her hands. Gradually and intentionally, she moved her face closer to his, and just when he imagined she was going to kiss him, she stopped and looked deep into his eyes. Mac thought he could almost see through her. Then she smiled, and her sense seemed to wrap themselves around him and lift a huge weight off his shoulders, as if he had been carting his gear in a backpack. Mac suddenly felt lighter than air, almost as if he were no longer touching the ground. She was hugging him without hugging him, or really without even touching him. Only when she pulled back, which was probably just seconds later, did he realize that he was still standing on his feet and that his feet were still touching the deck. "Oh, don't mind her. She has that effect on everyone." "I like it." All three burst into more laughter, and now Mac found himself laughing along with them, not knowing exactly why and not really caring either. When they finally stopped giggling, the large woman put her arm around Mac's shoulders and drew him to her. "Okay, we know who you are, but we should probably introduce ourselves to you. I," she waved her hands with a flourish, "and the housekeeper and cook. You may call me Elucia."
"Elucia?"
asked Mac, not comprehending at all.
"Okay, you don't have to call me Elucia. It's just a name I'm rather fond of and has particular meaning to me."
"So," she crossed her arms and put one hand under her chin as if thinking especially hard.
"You could call me what Nan does."
"What? You don't mean..." Now Mac was surprised and even more confused. Surely this was not the papa who sent the note.
"I mean, are you saying papa?"
"Yes," she responded and smiled, waiting for him to speak as if he were about to say something, which he was not at all. "And I," interrupted the man, who looked to be about in his 30s and stood a little shorter than Mac himself. "I tried to keep things fixed up around here. I enjoy working with my hands, although, as these two will tell you, I take pleasure in cooking and gardening as much as they do."
"You look as if you're from the Middle East, maybe Arab?"
"Actually, I'm a stepbrother of that great family. I am Hebrew, to be exact, from the house of Judah."
Then you are...
"Jesus, yes, and you may call me that if you like. After all, it has become my common name. My mother called me Yeshua, but I have also been known to respond to Joshua or even Jesse."
Mac stood dumbfounded and mute. What he was looking at and listening to simply would not compute. It was also impossible. But here he was.
Or was he really here at all? Suddenly, he felt faint. Emotion swept over him as his mind attempted desperately to catch up with all the information. Just as he was about to crumple to his knees, the Asian woman stepped closer and deflected his attention.
"And I am Sarayu."
She tilted her head in a slight bow and smiled. "Keeper of the gardens, among other things." Thoughts tumbled over each other as Max struggled to figure out what to do. Was one of these people God? What if they were hallucinations, or angels, or God was coming later? That could be embarrassing. Since there were three of them, maybe this was a Trinity sort of thing. But two women and a man, and none of them white,
Then again, why had he naturally assumed that God would be white? He knew his mind was rambling, so he focused on the one question he most wanted answered. Then, which one of you is God?
I am,
said all three in unison. Mac looked from one to the next, and even though he couldn't begin to grasp what he was seeing and hearing, he somehow believed them. A piece of pie. No matter what God's power may be, the first aspect of God is never that of the absolute master, the Almighty. It is that of the God who puts himself on our human level and limits himself. Jacques Ellul, Anarchy and Christianity.
Well, Mackenzie, don't just stand there gawking with your mouth open like your pants are full. Come and talk to me while I get supper on. Or if you don't want to do that, you can do whatever you want. Behind the cabin, she gestured over the roof without looking or slowing down, you will find a fishing pole by the boat shed that you can use to catch some lake trout.
She stopped at the door to give Jesus a kiss. She turned to look back at Mac.
Just remember, you gotta clean what you catch.
Then, with a quick smile, she disappeared into the cabin, armed with Mac's winter coat and still carrying the gun by two fingers, a full arm's length away from her. Mac was standing there with his mouth indeed open and an expression of bewilderment plastered to his face. He hardly noticed when Jesus walked over and put an arm around his shoulder. Sarayu seemed to have just evaporated.
"Isn't she great?"
Mac turned and faced him, shaking his head.
"Am I going crazy? Am I supposed to believe that God is a big black woman with a questionable sense of humor?"
"She's a riot. You can always count on her to throw you a curve or two. She loves surprises. And even though you might not think it, her timing is always perfect."
"Really?" said Mac, still shaking his head, and not sure if he really believed that. "So now, what am I supposed to do?"
"You're not supposed to do anything. You're free to do whatever you like."
Jesus paused and then continued, trying to help by giving Mac a few suggestions. "I am working on a wood project in the shed. Sarayu is in the garden, or you could go fishing, canoeing, or go in and talk to Papa."
"Well, I sort of feel obligated to go in and talk to him, her.
"Oh, don't go because you feel obligated. That won't get you any points around here. Go because it's what you want to do."
Mac thought for a moment and decided that going into the cabin actually was what he wanted to do. He thanked Jesus, who smiled, turned, and headed off to his workshop, and Mac stepped across the deck and up to the door. Again, he was alone, but after a quick look around, he carefully opened it. He stuck his head in, hesitated, and then decided to take the plunge.
"God?"
He felt more than a little foolish.
"I'm in the kitchen, Mackenzie. Just follow my voice."
He walked in and scanned the room. Could this even be the same place? He shuddered at the whisper of lurking dark thoughts and again locked them out. Across the room, a hallway disappeared at an angle. Glancing around the corner into the living room, his eyes searched out the spot near the fireplace. But there was no stain marring the wood surface. He noticed that the room was decorated tastefully, with art that looked like it had been either drawn or handcrafted by children. He wondered if this woman treasured each of these pieces like any parent who loves her children would. Maybe that was how she valued anything that was given to her from the heart, the way children seem to give so easily. Mac followed her soft humming down a short hallway and into an open kitchen dining area, complete with a small four-seat table and wicker-back chairs. The inside of the cabin was roomier than he had expected. Papa was working on something with her back to him, flour flying as she swayed to the music of whatever she was listening to. The song obviously came to an end, marked by a couple of last shoulder and hip shakes. Turning to face him, she took off the earphones. Suddenly, Mac wanted to ask 1,000 questions, or say 1,000 things, some of them unspeakable and terrible. He was sure that his face betrayed the emotions he was battling to control, and then, in a flash of a second, he shoved everything back into his battered heart's closet,
locking the door on the way out. If she knew his inner conflict, she showed nothing by her expression, still open, full of life and inviting. "May I ask what you're listening to? You really want to know?" "Sure." Now Mac was curious. "West Coast Juice. Group called Diatribe, and an album that isn't even out yet called Heart Trips." "Actually," she winked at Mac, "these kids haven't even been born yet."
"Right.
West Coast Juice, huh? It doesn't sound very religious." "Oh, trust me, it's not. More like Eurasian funk and blues with a message, and a great beat." She sidestepped toward Mac as if she were doing a dance move and clapped. Mac stepped back. "So God listens to funk?" Mac had never heard funk talked about in any properly righteous terms. "I thought you would be listening to George Beverly Shea or the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, you know, something churchier." "Now, see here, Mackenzie, you don't have to be looking out for me. I listen to everything, and not just to the music itself, but the hearts behind it. Don't you remember your seminary classes? These kids ain't saying anything I haven't heard before. They're just full of vinegar and fizz. Lots of anger, and I must say, with some good reason, too. They're just some of my kids, showing and spouting off. I am especially fond of those boys, you know. Yep, I'll be keeping my eye on them." Mac struggled to keep up with her, to make some sense of what was happening. None of his old seminary training was helping in the least. He was at a sudden loss for words, and his million questions had all seemed to abandon him. So he stated the obvious. "You must know calling you Papa is a bit of a stretch for me." "Oh, really? Of course I know. I always know. But tell me, why do you think it's hard for you? Is it because it's too familiar for you? Or maybe because I'm showing myself as a woman, a mother, or..." "Well, no small issue there. Or maybe it's because of the failures of your own Papa." Mac gasped involuntarily. He wasn't used to having deep secrets surface so quickly and openly. Instantly, guilt and anger welled up, and he wanted to lash out with a sarcastic remark in response. Mac felt as if he were dangling over a bottomless chasm, and was afraid if he let any of it out, he would lose control of everything. He sought for safe footing, but was only partially successful. "Maybe it's because I've never known anyone I could really call Papa." At that, she put down the mixing bowl that had been cradled in her arm, and leaving the wooden spoon in it, she turned toward Mac with tender eyes. She didn't have to say it. He knew she understood what was going on inside of him, and somehow he knew she cared about him more than anyone ever had. "If you let me, Mac, I'll be the Papa you never had." The offer was at once inviting and at the same time repulsive. He'd always wanted a Papa he could trust, but he wasn't sure he'd find it here, especially if this one couldn't even protect his Missy. A long silence hung between them. Mac was uncertain what to say, and she was in no hurry to let the moment pass easily. "If you couldn't take care of Missy, how can I trust you to take care of me?" There. He'd said it. The question that had tormented him every day of the great sadness. Mac felt his face flush angry red as he stared at what he now considered to be some odd characterization of God, and he realized his hands were knotted into fists. Tears began to trail down her cheeks. "Mac, I'm so sorry. I know what a great gulf this has put between us. I know you don't understand this yet, but I am especially fond of Missy. And you, too." He loved the way she said Missy's name, and yet he hated it coming from her. It rolled off her tongue like the sweetest wine, and even through all the fury still raging in his mind, he somehow knew she meant it. He wanted to believe her, and slowly some of his rage began to subside. "That's why you're here, Mac. I want to heal the wound that has grown inside of you and between us." To gain some control, he turned his eyes toward the floor. It was a full minute before he had enough to whisper without looking up.
I think I'd like that. But I don't see how. Honey, there's no easy answer that will take your pain away. Believe me, if I had one, I'd use it now. I have no magic wand to wave over you and make it all better. Life takes a bit of time and a lot of relationship.
Mac was glad they were stepping back from the edge of his ugly accusation. It had scared him how near he had come to being totally overwhelmed by it.
I think it'd be easier to have this conversation if you weren't wearing a dress.
He attempted a smile, as weak as it was.
If it were easier, then I wouldn't be. I'm not trying to make this harder for either of us. But this is a good place to start. I often find that getting head issues out of the way first makes the heart stuff easier to work on later, when you're ready.
She picked up the wooden spoon again, dripping with some sort of batter. Mackenzie, I am neither male nor female, even though both genders are derived from my nature. If I choose to appear to you as a man or a woman, it's because I love you. For me to appear to you as a woman and suggest that you call me Papa is simply to mix metaphors to help you keep from falling so easily back into your religious conditioning.
She leaned forward as if to share a secret. To reveal myself to you as a very large, white grandfather figure with flowing beard like Gandalf would simply reinforce your religious stereotypes. And this weekend is not about reinforcing your religious stereotypes.
Mac almost laughed out loud and wanted to say, "You think? I'm over here barely believing that I'm not stark raving mad." Instead, he focused on what she had just said and regained his composure. He believed, in his head at least, that God was a spirit, neither male nor female, but in spite of that, he was embarrassed to admit to himself that all his visuals for God were very white and very male. She stopped talking, but only long enough to put away some seasonings into a spice rack on a ledge by the window, and then turned to face him again. She looked at Mac intently.
"Hasn't it always been a problem for you to embrace me as your father? And after what you've been through, you couldn't very well handle a father right now, could you?"
He knew she was right, and he realized the kindness and compassion in what she was doing. Somehow, the way she had approached him had skirted his resistance to her love. It was strange and painful, and maybe even a little bit wonderful. But then, he paused, still focused on staying rational. "Why is there such an emphasis on you being a father? I mean, it seems to be the way you most reveal yourself."
"Well," responded Papa, turning away from him and bustling around the kitchen, "there are many reasons for that, and some of them go very deep. Let me say for now that we knew once the creation was broken, true fathering would be much more lacking than mothering. Don't misunderstand me. Both are needed. But an emphasis on fathering is necessary because of the enormity of its absence."
Mac turned away a bit bewildered, feeling he was already in over his head. As he reflected, he looked through the window at a wild-looking garden.
"You knew I would come, didn't you?"
"Of course I did." She was busy again, her back to him.
"Then was I free not to come? Did I not have a choice in the matter?"
Papa turned back to face him, now with flour and dough in her hands.
"Good question. How deep would you like to go?"
She didn't wait for a response, knowing that Mac didn't have one. Instead, she asked, "Do you believe you are free to leave?"
"I suppose I am."
"Am I?"
"Of course you are. I'm not interested in prisoners. You're free to walk out that door right now and go home to your empty house. Or you could go down to the grind and hang out with Willie. Just because I know you're too curious to go, does that reduce your freedom to leave?"
She paused only briefly and then turned back to her task, talking to him over her shoulder. "Or, if you want to go just a wee bit deeper, we could talk about the nature of freedom itself. Does freedom mean that you are allowed to do whatever you want to do? Or we could talk about all the limiting influences in your life that actively work against your freedom. Your family genetic heritage, your specific DNA, your metabolic uniqueness, the quantum stuff that is going on at a subatomic level where only I am the always present observer. Or the intrusion of your soul's sickness that inhibits and binds you. Or the social influences around you. Or the habits that have created synaptic bonds and pathways in your brain. And then there's advertising, propaganda, and paradigms. Inside that confluence of multifaceted inhibitors, what is freedom, really?" Mac just stood there not knowing what to say. "Only I can set you free, Mackenzie. But freedom can never be forced." "I don't understand. I don't even understand what you just told me." She turned back and smiled. "I know. I didn't tell you so that you would understand right now. I told you for later. At this point, you don't even comprehend that freedom is an incremental process." Gently reaching out, she took Mac's hands in hers, flower covered and all, and looking him straight in the eyes, she continued, "Mackenzie, the truth shall set you free. And the truth has a name. He's over in the woodshop right now, covered in sawdust. Everything is about him. And freedom is a process that happens inside a relationship with him. Then all that stuff you feel churning around inside will start to work its way out." "How can you really know how I feel?" Mac asked, looking back into her eyes. Papa didn't answer, only looked down at their hands. His gaze followed hers, and for the first time Mac noticed the scars in her wrists, like those he now assumed Jesus also had on his. She allowed him to tenderly touch the scars, outlines of a deep piercing, and he finally looked up again into her eyes. Tears were slowly making their way down her face, little pathways through the flower that dusted her cheeks. "Don't ever think that what my son chose to do didn't cost us dearly. Love always leaves a significant mark. We were there together." Mac was surprised. "At the cross? Now, wait, I thought you left him. You know, my God, why hast thou forsaken me?" It was a scripture that had often haunted Mac in the great sadness. "You misunderstand the mystery there. Regardless of what he felt at that moment, I never left him." "How can you say that? You abandoned him just like you abandoned me." "Mackenzie, I never left him, and I have never left you." "That makes no sense to me." "I know it doesn't, at least not yet. Will you at least consider this when all you can see is your pain? Perhaps then you lose sight of me." When Mac did not respond, she turned back to her cooking so as to offer him a little needed space. She seemed to be preparing a number of dishes all at once, adding various spices and ingredients. Humming a haunting little tune, she put the finishing touches on the pie that she'd been making and slid it into the oven. Don't forget, the story didn't end in his sense of forsakenness. He found his way through it, to put himself completely into my hands. Oh, what a moment that was. Mac leaned against the counter somewhat bewildered. His emotions and thoughts were all jumbled. Part of him wanted to believe everything Papa was saying. That would be nice. But another part was objecting rather loudly. This can't possibly be true. Papa reached for the kitchen timer, gave it a little twist, and placed it on the table in front of them. I'm not who you think I am, Mackenzie. Her words weren't angry or defensive. Mac looked at her, looked at the timer, and sighed. I feel totally lost. Then let's see if we can find you in this mess. almost as if on cue, a blue jay landed on the kitchen windowsill and began strutting back and forth. Papa reached into a tin on the counter and, sliding the window open, offered Mr. Jay a mixture of grains that she must have kept just for that purpose. Without any hesitation, and with a seeming air of humility and thankfulness, the bird walked straight to her hand and began feeding. Consider our little friend here. Most birds were created to fly. Being grounded for them is a limitation within their ability to fly, not the other way around. She paused to let Mac think about her statement. You, on the other hand, were created to be loved. So for you to live as if you were unloved is a limitation, not the other way around. Mac nodded his head, not so much in full agreement, but more as a signal that at least he understood and was tracking. That seemed simple enough. Living unloved is like clipping a bird's wings and removing its ability to fly. Not something I want for you. There's the rub. He didn't feel particularly loved at the moment. Mac, pain has a way of clipping our wings and keeping us from being able to fly. She waited a moment, allowing her words to settle. And if left unresolved for very long, you could almost forget that you were ever created to fly in the first place. Mac was silent. Strangely, the silence was not that uncomfortable. Mac looked at the little bird. The bird looked back at Mac. He wondered if it was possible for birds to smile. At least Mr. Jay looked like he was, perhaps, if only sympathetically. I'm not like you, Mac. It wasn't a put-down. It was a simple statement of fact. But to Mac, it felt like a splash of cold water. I am God. I am who